Okay. So I know that earlier this morning some of you heard your Dana's class and she talked about autonomy. I'm not going to speak about autonomy as much today. The way I titled this was End of Life Issues. So let's try to keep it at that. There's enough end of life issues to keep us busy. Let's hope that we stay in life and don't have to deal with end of life issues. But it is something which most people at some point do have to deal with. And generally when things like this happen, then people don't know what to do. And doctors, as I said last time, at some point in the middle, doctors are very often more concerned with legal issues than they are with medical issues. And that's unfortunately part of the reality of medical care. In the first source that we looked at, there is a contradiction there. First of all, you all appreciate that the source itself is an agadic source. It's a story. It's a sad story. It's a story which you absolutely are permitted to study on Tisha B'Av, and I'm sure many people will quote this kind, if not specifically this story, on Tisha B'Av. It's a story of persecution, it's a story of torture, and a story of execution. In the middle of the story, we have the students who are horrified to witness their rabbi being tortured. But not only is he being tortured, but he's being tortured together with a Sefer Torah which is being burned. And apparently, they were trying to do this in as painful a way as possible, by wrapping in the Torah, putting damp cloths on his chest, setting him aflame so that he won't die too quickly. His daughter, it doesn't tell us which daughter, we know that one of his daughters' name was Bruria. Right? The famous Bruria is Rabbi Hanina ben Tradion's daughter. One of his daughters says, "Father, how can I see you like this?" And he says, "You know, he who take vengeance on the Torah will take vengeance for my life as well." The students then ask what you see, which of course, again, is an agadic, perhaps mystical vision. He says, "What do you see?" He says, "I see the Torah is being burnt, but the letters are going up into heaven," which we understand to mean that you can destroy the physical, but the spiritual will not be destroyed. So then they turn to him and say, if that's the case, then try to take in the flames a little bit quicker, open your mouth, take in the flames, take in the smoke, so that to your body can go, but your soul will go up into heaven. And they see a parallel. He then makes a very heroic statement. He says, "Let he who gave life take life, and let a person not harm himself. Mutav sheyitlena misha natna, ba'al yachbol hu ba'atzmo. Let he who gave life take life, and let a person not harm himself." And let's be honest, if this source ended right here, it would be very, very simple. It would be very, very simple. We would have a direct, quote-unquote, Torah perspective. Life is precious. Life, one must claw at life and hold on to life as long as we could, and let man never do anything to limit life in any way, shape, or form. The problem, of course, is that the story continues. And as a theme, as a philosophical idea, it's phenomenal that the executioner who's witnessing this, perhaps he also sees the letters going up into heaven, and he gets taken away by the whole situation, and he turns and says to the victim, "If I were to increase the flames and take away the sponge, would you take me into the world to come as well?" Now suddenly he's more concerned with the spiritual and the physical. And for a Roman executioner to say this, I think we all should appreciate the incredible statement. Again, philosophically, there's other things that would greatly disturb us. Again, this man has blood on his hands, has a great deal of blood on his hands. And just because he kills a rabbi, he's going to go into heaven afterwards? Again, think about this for a moment. And he says, "If I take away the sponge and I increase the flames, will you take me into the world to come. And he says, absolutely, he says, swear to me. He swears to him, and he does this, and he dies. And then the executioner jumps into the flames. One would assume that his future as an executioner in Rome was probably, let's put it this way, it probably wasn't the best career move for him to behave the way that he did. The Romans apparently had, as part of their motivation, was to cause as much humiliation and pain as possible. I'm sure all of you are thinking right now about the death of Rabbi Akiva as well. This is part of what their agenda is. And here this executioner takes away the pain, speeds up the death, and then jumps into the flames. There is a whole machloket in Judaism if non-Jews have a share of the world to come or not, so you can certainly use this as evidence that there are some times that non-Jews do have a share in the world to come, something which is evidenced in the Tosefta in the end of Sanhedrin, and the Rambam quotes it. Although in the Rambam's quotation, there's two different versions of it, which creates a whole dilemma. But apparently the Rambam would accept that non-Jews have a share in the world to come as well. Rabbi Soloveitchik was once asked about it, and he said, in what I believe was at least half-kidding remark, when somebody says, but he wasn't Jewish. So he says, normally, how do you become Jewish? You go into the mikveh. So he says, no, sometimes if you go mikveh, you do libun, like by Liban Gomor. And he says that he did Liban Gomor. And as I said, Rabbi Soloveitchik did say such a thing. But what one has to, and it's written down in his name, you have to be very, very careful, because I suspect he was not saying this with any degree of seriousness. But maybe what he was saying is, on a spiritual level, is that if this person's willing to jump into the flames, that's as good as any mikveh. Okay, let's understand. But our difficulty is the contradiction. You all notice the contradiction, correct? On the one hand, he says, let he who gave life take life. On the other hand, what does he say? Take away, oh sure, take away the sponge. And so that's difficult. This source began a discussion in terms of suicide, in terms of taking life, and in terms of murder, which the main reason I'm quoting it is for attitudes more so than anything else. The story afterwards, told in the Gemara in Gittin, of 400 children who were being taken from Rome, taken from Israel to Rome, where a rumor spread about the boat that they were going to be used for immoral purposes. And the question then comes up, if they kill themselves, will they have a share in the world to come or not? Now, what was the purpose of this story here? Just to really make sure that we understand it before we get to the Rishonim. What was the purpose of the story? There was one purpose. Where is the story written? So I'm sure none of you looked it up, right? Will you admit now that none of you looked up where the story is and where it's written and what the context is and what's the rest of the page and what's the rest of the chapter, right? You all? Right. You all agree. It's a series of stories, one after the other, of the stories of the Churban. Kamtza bar Kamtza, same place. All the stories about the Churban are written in the same section. And by the way, it's interesting, where is it written? Which Gemara? Gemara Gittin, which itself is interesting, that's the place that Chazal chose to put the stories about the Churban. Why that is, maybe I'll speak about on Tisha B'Av. But that itself is interesting, that it's in that chapter. The purpose of this story was the last line. What was the last line of the story? V'aleim ha'katuv omer, about people like this. This scripture says, ki alecha horagnu kol hayom, nechshavnu kitzon tavcha, that we were killed all day long and we went like sheep to a slaughter. What's the purpose of it? What's the purpose of the whole story? Not to tell you if morally they were right or they were wrong. What's the purpose of this? Is the moral's more than that. If 400 children died, that's the tragedy. The Gemara over here is not making a value judgment. The Gemara is not telling you they were right, not telling you they were wrong. It doesn't make a difference. Do you appreciate that or no? The purpose over here is, let me tell you a story of 400 children who died. I mean, there really isn't that much more to say about this. If 400 children died, and now you realize the tragedy of what's behind their death, of them having this whole discussion, how will we get to share in the world to come? That's the tragedy. Where faced in front of them is a choice of a life of immorality or death as children, and they choose death as children. That's the tragedy. The Gemara over here doesn't consider for a second what's the right moral choice and what's the wrong moral choice, because it's not the issue. Do you appreciate that? What? The issue in this context was, let me tell you another story about the tragedy of the Churban. And as I said, you go back and you look in context, you'll appreciate that point. Nonetheless, the Rishonim are troubled by the correctness or incorrectness of this behavior. And the Rishonim are willing to say that what these children did is correct. Now, there are various levels of the Rishonim. One of the first things that they do is they set up a contradiction. Didn't Rabbi Hanina ben Tradion say a person should never harm himself? So how can these 400 children then jump into the water and kill themselves? The answer which Tosfot brings, and I hope you appreciate this tragic point as well, Tosfot is not writing in a vacuum. You all know that Tosfot begins with the grandchildren of Rashi. One of those prominent members of Tosfot was Rabbeinu Tam. Rashi lives during the First Crusade. Tosfot lasts for a couple of hundred years and is spread out from England, France, Germany, whole area. They live through the Crusades. During the Crusades, Jews are again faced with absurd situations. One of the situations is it better to die as a Jew or to be baptized? And that question then can be added, is it better for your child to die as a Jew or to be baptized? Now, sometimes Jews were given choices. Sometimes the choice was convert or die. Sometimes Jews were killed and the children were then converted. That's the background of what jumps out of Rabbeinu Tam's mind when he's dealing with this. He's not only dealing with the tragedy of 400 children who lived a very long time ago during Churban Bayit Sheni. He's dealing with the tragedy of the children who live in the next town over from him, and the next town, and the next town, and the next town, and how do you face this? So here, if you look in... So let me just give you one more piece of background, and then we can continue, and that will give us, I think, the starting point to then really be able to deal with this issue properly. We all know that there are three things you give up your life for. We touched this last time as well. What are the three things? If somebody says to you, commit a sin of Gilui Arayot, Shfichut Damim, Avodah Zarah. Okay, that we know. What if somebody's not going to give you the choice? If somebody gives you the choice, says convert or die, so then it becomes easier. What if they don't give you the choice? What if...
They just say convert? I'm converting you.
Well, the question really became more problematic with children, right? Or in this case, the way the Tosfot understands it, these 400 children, again, if you look at the commentaries, what do you mean they felt they would be used for immoral purposes? They looked around the boat and they realized it was all the pretty girls and all the pretty boys. And they realized that they're going to spend the rest of their lives in a brothel. So now, now what's better? To die as a Jew jumping off of a boat? Or is it better to spend the rest of your life as a prostitute? And it's not like they're going to say, no, I protest. They're just not going to have a choice about this. As I said, that's a tragedy involved in this. Tosfot then says that, or, if you're afraid they're going to force you, and there's two ways that force can take place. One way force can take place is something is against your will. The other way that force can take place is that they can leverage you, and they can torture you, and they can make you do something that you would not have done under normal circumstances. So look at source 4 for a second. Omar Rabbeinu Tam, those are those first four letters. Omar Rabbeinu Tam, Dehecha Sheyere Im Penya Avirim Ovde Kochavim La Avera Kegon Ayide Yisurim. If someone is afraid that the non-Jews are going to force you to sin, for example, by torturing you, Shelo yuchal la'amod behem, you're not going to be able to withstand them. As hu mitzvah lechabal lechabel ba'atzmo ki hi degitin. Gabi yeladim shenishbu lekalon. Shitil atzmo liyam. If they're going to force you to do something, and you're afraid you're going to give in, then it's a mitzvah for you to kill yourself. And by the way, that's a remarkable statement. Do you all realize why it's remarkable? Do you realize why it's remarkable? You're going back to autonomy. I told you, autonomy doesn't...
But it's a totally subjective thing.
But it's worse than that. It's far worse than that. The math doesn't work.
You kill yourself, there's nothing left.
No, it's worse than that. What are the three things you're not allowed to do? Right. So you're allowed to kill yourself to avoid one of these three. What's the problem? One second. What's the problem? What's the problem? Killing yourself is one of the three things. Shvichut damim. Do you understand the paradox? It goes one step worse than that. Did you all get the two leaps of Rabbeinu Tam? In source 5, the Ritva quotes, the Ritva lives in Islamic Spain. There was a Christian Spain, Islamic Spain. He lives in Islamic Spain. Katav b'guyon ha'tosfei, shehoyer omer Rabbeinu Tam, tehecha shemityurei shelo yachrichu la'avor al hadat, mutar lechbo batzmo. If a person's afraid they're going to force you to convert, you're allowed to harm yourself. We've already seen that. Mikan lomdin, and here Rabbeinu Tam learned, lishchot hane'arim, to murder children, to slaughter children, b'gzerot, during the time of the Crusades, so they shouldn't be baptized. Adkan matzati b'gyonei Tosfot. He goes, this is what I found written in Tosfot. Vehim dvarim shetzrichim talmud ve'iyun gadol. This is the kind of thing which needs an incredible amount of study and in-depth study. Elo shekvar harazakein. That is what Rabbeinu Tam ruled. V'shamanu b'shem gdolei Tzarfat. The Ritva made inquiries, and he said, I've heard from the great rabbis in France. Sheiturkin halacha lemaaseh. Rabbeinu Tam allowed this halacha lemaaseh. He instructed people to kill their children. By the way, we have historical evidence about this. One of the most tragic tshuvot, which comes down to us from the Middle Ages, is somebody who wrote the Maharam from Wittenberg. Right? Do you all know who the Maharam was? Maharam is very timely to mention. The Maharam in Wittenberg was himself the greatest rabbi of his age. He was kidnapped, and he was held hostage, and he spent the last number of years of his life in prison, and he instructed the Jewish community under no condition to redeem him. He said, if you redeem me, then the price will go up on Jews, and absolutely not. And it's based on a Mishnah, also in Gittin, and the Mishnah uses a very strange term to describe this. It calls it Tikkun Olam. I know a lot of Jews understand Tikkun Olam is to make the world a prettier place, a nicer place. It says the Mishnah says, don't overpay for a captive because of Tikkun Olam. Because if you overpay, you're not making the world a better place. And what it means is, have micro considerations and macro considerations. If you overpay for a captive, on a micro level, you saved one person. On a macro level, you've made the world a worse place. It takes a lot. It maybe doesn't take as much guts to rule about a case like this when you're talking about somebody else, but when you're talking about yourself, he absolutely forbade his community to pay the money to get him out. He ended up dying in prison. He ended up spending the next number of years, his body remained in prison, and many years later, somebody got his body out. I visited his grave in Germany a number of years ago, but again, it took a long time till they even took his remains out, and he got proper burial. But that was based on his instructions. As I was saying, one of the most tragic tshuvot you will ever read, and I chose not to bring it today, I'll just quote it quickly, is of a man who writes to the Maharam and said, during the Crusades, I killed my wife and children, do I need to do tshuva for this? And how do you answer such a query? I do want to stress another thing. Later authorities reject Rabbeinu Tam. Again, and I want you to appreciate, Rabbeinu Tam, at the time that he said this, was the leading rabbi most likely in the world and certainly in Europe. And that's how strongly he felt about the Crusades, and that's how he felt what this particular challenge was in that time, in that place. But let's think about what he does say. What he is telling us, therefore, is that there are times that death is preferable to life, and not only that, there are times that you're allowed to kill somebody. Now, of course, What he is claiming is that the reason for this is that if you kill the person, and it's very circular, I cannot get you out of this. I will not be able to help you now. He's claiming that to live a life of being baptized, a life in his mind of avodah zarah, is breaking one of the three things. You have no choice about it, therefore it's better to die. And if they would say to you, either die or convert, then you have to say, okay, you're going to kill me, then kill me. If they're not going to give you the choice, it's better to be dead. How do I know it's better to be dead? Because we already said, it's better to die if you have the choice. If you don't have the choice, or if you're afraid you're going to give in, so that was the first level, he said, then you're allowed to kill yourself. So, but why? Wouldn't I have thought that that's one of the three things, that itself is shvichut damim? And then he jumps to another level and says, not only do we now have a value judgment, that it's better to be dead, which means even kill yourself, you can even kill somebody else who you're afraid that they're going to break one of these three things. As I said, this is a remarkable, remarkable statement. But the truth is, if we're going to discuss the idea of euthanasia, the idea of end-of-life issues, this does become important. And it becomes important for real and imagined reasons. When I say imagined reasons, let me jump all the way over to the Holocaust. In the Holocaust, there was an individual who comes over to his rabbi, and he says, I know what's really going on. And he was in one of these small towns. And he says, I know what's going on. I know the Nazis are coming into the towns. They're lining up all the people, and they're killing the young people in front of the old people. They're making them watch this. They're making them witness this. They're humiliating them, torturing them, and then they're killing them. And he says, I know that that's going to happen to us as well. I want permission from my rabbi to kill myself so I don't have to go through this kind of pain. I cannot stand this. And the ruling, and again, I want to stress something. Even discussing tshuvot like this is itself a tragedy. And the ruling that was given in this particular context, I believe, was wrong. And he said that you are allowed to kill yourself. And his reasoning was based upon a shelot and tshuvot called the Besamim Rosh. The Besamim Rosh, which was published a couple of hundred years, 150 years ago, the Besamim Rosh claimed to be a lost manuscript of the Rush. The Rush was also one of the Balei HaTosfot. And this followed the same line of reasoning, which means if you are in an uncomfortable situation, you're allowed to take your life. If it's difficult for you, yes? If you're... Don't worry so much about this, because the truth is the Besamim Rosh is a notorious forgery. And the Rush is asked all kinds of very interesting modern questions. Could men go with clean shaven? And there's like question after question in this book, which it's very hard to believe that the Rush would have been asked these questions 700 years ago. Incidentally, the individual who published this said that if you are in an incredible amount of pressure, you're sick, you don't feel well, whatever, then one is allowed to take life, because we see over here, Rabbeinu Tam said, there are times that one can take one's life. Incidentally, the person who was accused of being the forger of the book committed suicide. But then again, it was written in the book, so I guess. That's only according to Rabbeinu Tam. No one else would say you would kill yourself. Everyone else would say you were allowed to let yourself be killed. Aside from Rabbeinu Tam, no one said this. The Yamashel Shlomo, again, I didn't bother giving you the source, he said Rabbeinu Tam is wrong on this, with all due respect. He said that first leap that he takes is wrong. You're not allowed to take a preemptive strike and kill yourself. What is a more interesting question is regarding in times of war and spies and things like that, if they're afraid that they may give up information and by killing themselves they're saving other people. That's a more interesting question, but my very strong suspicion is that rules of war are very different from rules of other times. And just like in war, you're allowed to kill the enemy. Under normal circumstances, you can't kill people. It could be under... In times of war, one is allowed to kill themselves as well. But that, as I said, is a completely different analysis, completely different situation. So Shemad is also... For anything, right, but not to kill yourself. As I said, the leap of Rabbeinu Tam is to decide that to kill yourself is also okay. So as I said, there, because of this Rabbeinu Tam, this later source, the Besamim Rosh, got introduced. If you accept the Besamim Rosh, all euthanasia is okay. It's very, very simple. If you accept the Besamim Rosh, when are you allowed to kill yourself or somebody if they're in pain? If they're in pain, you can kill them. Why? Because they're in a great deal of pain. They can't stand the pain. There's no... according to the Besamim Rosh, what can't you do? you can't play Russian roulette, right? Because that's irresponsible. But if you're in pain, you can kill yourself. But as I said, there are those people still today who do not recognize that this source is a forgery. Already the Chatam Sofer, if you look for a moment in source 21, he goes through the case of Rav Chanina ben Tradion, right? Why don't you open up your mouth and so on? And where it's underlined, go to the second to the end of the second line to the bottom, which is underlined, right? She kanes bo ha'esh va'ama mutav she'lenu misha natna va'al yishlotu ba'atzmo ubize nizdayef, right? It's ziyuf. He forged nizdayef sefer b'samim rosh u'marachad afil ha'mietzer biyoter mikol makom. Even if somebody's in pain, they're allowed to kill themselves. So the Chatam Sofer already, 200 years ago, identified the b'samim rosh as being a forgery and saying that you can't say this. As I said, unfortunately, during the Holocaust, when, again, I'm not judging anyone, the rabbi who was asked this question had no books in front of him. He remembered that there was such a case. He knew it was extreme. The Holocaust is an extreme situation. During extreme situations, you go to extreme sources, and he relied on this b'samim rosh, which is, again, as far as I'm concerned, it's very easy for me. I can sit and I have my library, and I have my computers, and I can look up sources, and I have a lot of time to prepare. When he's asked the question, he relied on the b'samim rosh. But as I said, if you accept that source, then there's really nothing for us to talk about. When you're in pain, you can kill yourself. When you're in pain, you have someone else kill you. So as I said, that was really the reason that I got into all this, although there's one thing that still bothers me. And that's, we have to resolve before we finish. What bothers me still? You still with me? Oh, I lost you already. What still bothers me? When he said, let he who gave life take life, that's great. But when he said, when the executioner says, but I'll, that's a contradiction, and that we need to resolve. So that's interesting. A number of the Achronim try to go in that direction, and but if it's murder, it's murder. If it's, yeah. She's very good. You hear that? Mm-hmm. I think that I agree completely. I think that if anyone else would have said, I'll take away your pain, they would have been guilty of murder. Why is it not a problem for the executioner? Because he's already guilty for killing this person. He's already guilty for killing this person. So, meaning, what changes in terms of his, you know, his, what do you call it, his status. No, if you go up and you're... No, if anything, he only improves somewhat because you take away the torture aspect. I mean, he's really guilty of this murder. So that's what I was thinking as well as far as a distinction. But there's another issue which is important. Yeah.
Well, the stuff that's being taken away...
Yes. So let's. Okay. So let's take a look and to see the sources that deal with this issue. Let's deal with the issues, with the sources that deal with this issue. And there's really two levels to this. One level is the level of prayer, and the other level is a level of action. Obviously, the question of action is very significant. Can a person be pulled? Can you take someone off a respirator? I'll start with an easier question. Do you have to put somebody on a respirator? Could be you'd be obligated to do all you can to save life. So maybe you'd have to put somebody on a respirator. Again, I'm just raising that as a question. Are you ever allowed to hope that somebody will die? Are you allowed to pray that someone should die? Yeah. So that's... What? I want to start, though, with the action case. The case that the Shulchan Aruch ends up quoting is source 12. How many of you got to the source? Okay. We're going to start with 12, and then we'll move backwards a bit. Source 12 is written in a book called the Sefer Chassidim. The Sefer Chassidim has nothing to do with Chassidim. It was written by Rav Yehuda HaChassid, who's from the same time and place, more or less, as Rabbeinu Tam. Chassidei Ashkenaz lived in Germany going back 800 years. The Sefer Chassidim, by the way, is a remarkable book because it's basically his own family's ethical will. He writes the book to his children, grandchildren, saying, this is what I want you to do. Almost all the superstition you've ever heard about in Judaism comes from here. That you're not allowed to marry someone with the same name as your father, as your mother, as your sister, your brother. All that kind of things come here. There's all kinds of things that come from this book. On the other hand, there is a lot of halacha that comes from the book as well. It's a very, very interesting book. Over here, in this section, and the first difficulty with this is that this is a double negative, so just the nature of English versus Hebrew. Ein gormim la'adam shelo yamut mehira. How do you translate that? You shouldn't cause a person not to die quickly. Or say that in a simpler English? No. Ein gormim la'adam shelo yamut mehira. Don't do something a person won't die quickly. Kigon shahaya echad goses. For example, there's a person who was a goses. Now, goses is a technical term, which is not a simple term. Rav Moshe, when he's asked what a goses is, he says doctors that deal with it know what a goses is. You can't be a goses more than 3 days. A goses is somebody who is actively dying. If you're sufficiently depressed, then everyone's actively dying, right? From the day you're born, you're dying, right? But actively dying means that you are in the process of dying. Somebody's actually dying in front of you. So if somebody's a goses, voya echad karov l'oto bayit chotev etzim, and outside of the same home where you have your goses, you have a wood chopper. So you have the goses taking their last breath, and then you hear a loud sound, and you have a jolt. I mean, like in all the movies and stuff, you actually do... You shock them, and that can work to bring somebody even if they... Right. This source imagines, again, it sets up... One of the great difficulties of years ago was not having medical equipment to be able to determine things like life and death. I mean, there were places, this is one of the big problems that happened a couple hundred years ago, is that you had places that did not want to allow burials to take place for 72 hours. And, you know, Jews like to have burials as quickly as possible. And the reason they wanted burials for 72 hours is because the incidence when people were wrong was pretty high. You couldn't always determine if a person was alive or dead. Over here, he considers this person to be goses and someplace in between this world and the next. A loud sound comes from outside. The person's eyes open up. Here's the question. Do you tell the woodchopper, stop chopping? Do you tell the woodchopper, keep on chopping? Or do you just not do anything, let the woodchopper do what he does, and you do what you do? So again, there's three possibilities here. One is do nothing. Two is to stop the woodchopper, and three is to encourage the woodchopper. What does it actually tell us over here? The person can't die. Person's trying to die. Misirin hachotev misham, you remove the wood chopper from there. Ve'ein misimim melach al lishono kidei shelo yamut. Now this is very important. You have to go back to medical practices of the Middle Ages. You all know that if somebody passes out, you can put smelling salts in order to bring them back. Over here, one of the things that they would do to prevent somebody from passing out, they would put very strong salt under their tongue. As a stimulant. Right, because it's so distasteful, it would prevent somebody from passing out. Again, that's the medical practice. So it says, don't put salt under the person's tongue, that they don't die, let the person die. V'im ghost says, v'omer eini yachol lamut ad shiyasimu b'mokom acher, al yaziyu m'sham. But if the ghost says, listen, I can't die over here, I want to be brought someplace else, don't touch them. Why don't touch them? So this is something we already learned in the Mishnah, is that a goses is like a candle which is flickering. And if you even touch a candle which is flickering on Shabbat, you can put it out. Over here as well, we're afraid of extinguishing the light of the goses. this case is mentioned by the Rama in the Shulchan Aruch and in his commentary to the Torah. Let's look in source 13. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 lines from the end. I think it's 6. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 7 lines if you count that word Megalchin. The word it begins Hachasid Zal from the Sefer of Yehuda Hachasid. You got it? In parentheses. V'chein asur legrom lemeit sheyemut mehira. Asur, right, you can't make a person die quicker. V'chein asur legrom lemeit sheyemut mehira. Kigon mishu hu goseis zman aroch. V'lo yecholi parade. Asur leshmit hakar v'hakeset mitachtav. Mikol sh'ar m'sheish notzot mitzat ofot shegormim zeh. V'chein lo yazizu mimkomo. He starts off by saying, you shouldn't do something to speed up death. For example, he says, let's say the goseis is lying there in bed, and Annie has a pillow, and you're afraid that it's the feather in the pillow which is pricking him in the back of the head and disturbing him and not allowing the person to die. He says, don't touch the pillow. His main thing here is don't touch the goseis. You also can't put the keys of the shul underneath his head. Why would you put the keys of the shul underneath their head? The keys of the shul were considered to be have magical power to them. And therefore, if a person was in pain, anybody want the copy of the key to my shul? I'm willing to sell it to you. That the keys of the shul were considered to have power to them, and therefore it says, and also, don't move the person to put the keys of the shul under their head. Kadeshi parade, what? Okay, don't put that under the head either. Aval im yesh sham davar shagorim ikuv yitzia tenefesh, but if there's something which is preventing death, kagon sheyesh samach lo tobayit kol dofei kagon chotev etzim. But let's say that something near, that there's something preventing death. For example, there's a woodchopper. O sheyesh melech al shana, or there is already. Okay, this is different for the Sefer Chasidim. What does the Sefer Chasidim say? Someone's trying to die, don't put it there. What did he say? If it's already there, right, you're allowed to take it away. Ve'elu ma'akim tzira nefesh. So he's saying, take away. Now, by the way, you all would have been willing to make a distinction between removing salt and removing the woodchopper. Why? Because one is external and one is on the person. And in the Shulchan Aruch, the Rama brings both of them in one breath. Now, over here he says, Mutar lahasiru misham. One is permitted. In his commentary to the Torah, he wrote, Chayav. The difference between saying that you're obligated to and you're allowed to, it may make a very big difference, but I am pointing out that someplace elsewhere, the same person quotes this. There he says, Chayav. Because you haven't done anything. You've taken away something which is preventing death. Now, let's be honest about what we just now saw, because there were two sides of the coin over here. What is it that he said? On the one hand, he said you can't do something to speed up death. On the other hand, what did he say? You can't do something to slow down death. Right? Both of those statements he would consider to be extremely important. And he says them, as I said, absolutely together. Don't speed up death, but don't slow down death either. Which means the process of death is something which we have to realize that we don't necessarily have the right to be involved in. Now, how proactive can one be? And let me raise one other question. The Sefer Chasidim, as I told you already, there are a lot of things in the book which are based upon beliefs and magic and so on. Is there a halachic source for this? Now, one reason why you have to take this a little more seriously, and again, with all due respect, because even he, when he wrote the book, he said, this is for my family. These are spiritual things that I realize. Over here, the Rama took this and put it into the Shulchan Aruch. That itself makes it significant for us. But part of the question that I would have is, what's his source? Where did you see a source for this? So did any of you come across a source for the Sefer Chasidim? Not only is it here. No, we don't need shovel. It's Rebbe's maid. Rebbe's maid. The maid of Rebbe Yehuda HaNasi. Right? You learned that today?
Yeah.
Yes. So where is Rebbe's maid? It's on page 3, source 7. It tells the day that Rebbe died, the rabbis declared a fast. And then they make a very strange statement. They say, whoever says that Rebbe is dead will be stabbed with a sword. Did any of you understand that? You don't understand that at all? It's a very bizarre statement. If anybody says Rebbe's dead, we're going to kill you. The Shita Mekubetzet said. The Shita Mekubetzet said in source 8 has a remarkable statement about this. Yidkar Becharev, the Ilu Havu Yodei Bibirur Demayit. For had they known clearly that he was dead, Lo Havu Boy Rachmele, then they wouldn't pray for him. Lo Havu Boy Rachmele Dilachaye Atchiat Hametim. They wouldn't have prayed that he would come back to life. Right? Chitame Lo Havu Boy, Lo Boy Rachme. What are they saying? What's he saying? If you know that somebody, I mean, there are various prayers that you can say. If somebody's very sick, all of us are prepared to pray for a miracle. Correct? You pray. You say it's 1 in 1 million, 1 in 10 million, you don't care. You pray for it. Have any of you ever said a prayer, I know he's dead already, but just do a little miracle and bring them back for a minute. You know, you can like change. I mean, that prayer is a little bit too far. There are limits to how far you can pray. By the way, could God bring somebody back? Sure. So what's the Shita Mekubetzet saying? What are the rabbis saying? Whoever says that he's dead, because once they would say he's dead, what would the people do? They would stop praying. And what would happen when they would stop praying? Then he would remain dead. What's the Shita Mekubetzet claiming? He's claiming that just because he's dead doesn't mean that he's going to stay dead. You can bring somebody back, but you can't know that you're bringing somebody back. Did you follow that?
Yes.
You can't pray for something which is ridiculous. But that doesn't mean that God can't do something which is ridiculous. And you can only pray for something if you think it's possible. If you think it's not possible, you can't pray for it, because then it's ridiculous. Right? You can't say a prayer which is absurd. So therefore, what do the rabbis insist? Even if he's dead, nobody say he, meaning nobody has the right to say that it's dead, that he's dead, we will keep on praying. And our prayers will keep him on this world. That's what the rabbis believe. By the way, were they right or were they wrong? They were right. they were right. Again, that's where this whole thing is coming from. It's because the Shita Mekubetzet, by the way, the Shita Mekubetzet is a collection of writings. It's not one person. Shita Mekubetzet, collection of writings. It was written by Rav Bezalel Ashkenazi, who lived in Egypt in the 16th century. He was the teacher of the Arizal. And he over here is obviously bothered by this. Like, how can they say whoever says that he's dead is going to stab him with a sword? Because if you say that he's dead, then you've just have killed him. Meaning, saying that he's dead is that you're the one who's just now killed him. So you asked me before about praying for miracles. You can pray for anything as long as it's possible. Once it becomes an absurdity, you can't pray for it because it's an absurdity. Did that make sense? Over here it says that the day that he died, they said whoever says that he's dead, they're going to stab him. They're all praying for him. They're standing below and praying. He's upstairs on his deathbed. He's in a great deal of pain. His maid, who, by the way, is a woman who's mentioned a number of times in the Talmud, never by name, only as Rebbe's maid, but she teaches halachot on various occasions. And she makes this wonderful philosophical observation. She says, Rebbe is wanted by those below, and Rebbe is wanted by those above. Let the forces of those below conquer those above. He continues in great pain. Apparently he had severe intestinal problems, and he continues in a great deal of pain, and she realizes that their prayers are keeping him on this world, but they're not making him better. At that point, she says, may it be the will of God that the forces above defeat the forces below, but they keep on praying, and she discerns that it is their prayers that holds them into this world. It then says that she takes a vase, throws it out the window, it crashes to the floor, they all stop praying for a moment. At that moment, Rebbe dies. They send one of the rabbis, Bar Kapara, they send him up to take a look and to see what's going on. He goes in, he sees that Rebbe has died, and it says that he tears his clothing, as one would if their Rebbe or the Gadol Hador died, tears his clothing in the Kriya, folds it over, comes back down, And they say, what happened? And he says there was a struggle between the angels and between above and people below, and the angels have won, and they have captured the holy ark, and they've taken it into captivity. And they say, what in the world are you talking about? Is Rebbe dead? And he says, you said it, not me. Right? That's the that was the Gemara. But what do you see from this Gemara? You see two things. One is you see, first of all, you see a very smart woman. But what else do you see? You see a woman who's not only able to see in front of her, she's able to see, you know, various textures of what's in front of her. But according to Chazal, she prays for him to get better, and she sees her prayers don't work. She sees their prayers are enough to hold him onto this world, but their prayers are not enough to heal him. So what does she then understand? That what are their prayers doing? And this is the fine distinction. Are their prayers giving life, or are their prayers preventing death? And don't tell me it's the same thing. Should I say that again? Are their prayers giving life, or are their prayers preventing death? She understands that the prayers are preventing death, and therefore she says that these prayers should stop. If I'm not mistaken, this is the source for the Sefer Chassidim. Because what does the Sefer Chassidim understand that the wood chopper is doing? Is the wood chopper giving life, or is the wood chopper preventing death? Right? That becomes the very, very fine distinction in this topic. Which means the Shulchan Aruch writes that if something is preventing death, you should remove the impediment to death. If something is giving life, that's a completely different situation. This then ends up flowing over into the discussion regarding prayer, that one should pray for someone to live and someone should pray for someone to get better, included in the whole discussion of Bikur Cholim. We all know there's a mitzvah of Bikur Cholim. What is the mitzvah of Bikur Cholim? The mitzvah is, it seems to be two levels. One is to help the person. The other is to pray for the person. What is not the mitzvah of Bikur Cholim? To visit the person. Bless you. Right? You would say, what's Bikur Cholim? To visit the person. He says, no. The purpose of Bikur Cholim is twofold. One, to help them with what they need. Two, is to pray for them. Absolutely. 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 No, hold it. Once you say they need the visits, that's helping the person. Sometimes visiting somebody, it causes more of a strain. Okay, again, I want to be very careful. Just visiting, if it helps the person, then you've done one. What you should also do is you should pray. It's interesting, if you look in the Shulchan Aruch, look at source 14. And that's why I cut through all the other sources. 14. Ein mevakrin tachol lebegimel sha'ot rishonot shel yom. Bebnei shekol chola mekil alav chalav beboker. Somebody would look better in the morning, and therefore, what's going to happen if they look better in the morning? You're going to think they're not so bad. V'lo yachush l'vakesh l'av rachman, and you're not going to bother praying for them. V'lo begimel sha'ot achronot shel yom, and not at the end of the day. Why? She'az nachbir alav chalav yitya'esh m'l'vakesh l'av rachman, and you're not going to pray for them because they'll be so weakened. The kol shebikur v'lo bikesh l'av rachamim lo kiyem hamitzvah. Anybody who visited somebody who was sick and didn't pray for them, you did not do the mitzvah. That part of the mitzvah of bikur cholim is to say a tefillah. By the way, be very careful about the tefillah, because if you follow the tefillah written here, you'll give them a heart attack and kill them. What is the tefillah that you should say? Let's look at the next line. Kishim vakesh l'av rachamim im vakesh l'fanav yochol vakesh b'chol loshon shiyirtzeh. If you say in front of them, you can say in any language. So, for example, what you should say, may God give you a refuah shlema. That is a prayer. That's wonderful. That's perfect. V'im vakesh shelo b'fanav lo yivakesh ela b'loshon hakodesh. But if you don't say it in front of the person, then it should be part of a formal prayer, and it's better to say it in Hebrew. And what should you say? Yichlol oto b'toch chole Yisrael. Include this sick person with all the sick of Israel. Sheyomar, what should you say? Hamakom yirachem, and see, it sounds too close to something else. Hamakom yirachem alecha b'toch chole Yisrael. Right. May God have compassion on you with all the other sick of Israel. Uvishabbat omer, Shabbat himilazok. Shabbat's not a time for screaming. Refuah krova lavo, and may healing come quickly. Sure. No, but over here, hamakom is what you say when you're not in front of them.
Yeah.
As I said, if you say this...
The second Shabbat.
Yeah, Shabbat Himi Lazok, you do. That's part of the Mishnah Berach. Part of Mishnah, Shabbat Himi Lazok.
They say
it's sure. Yeah. As I said, people don't say this anymore. And if you would say this to somebody, I think you'd frighten them. No, is this the right tefillah? Yes, this is the correct tefillah. But if you're in front of the person, what did we just see? It said in the same source, the line before, what is it? If you're in front of them, you say it in any language you want to. Which is the formal prayer is only if you're not in front of the person.
It's interesting, because one of the things, the position, you know, say to my own patients, my sick old patients, is that Hashem should give you the zoom. Because I can't see that they're going to get better. But I don't want them to get worse. And to give them the zoom, it gives them balance and quality of life.
Balance. Now, what was this tefillah? That's what I wanted to focus on. What was the tefillah that you say here? God should have compassion. Now, God having compassion, we both recognize that can play itself out in different ways. That's what's very significant to this tefillah, right? You all understood that point? Okay.
I think
I'm just saying, if you start with and you say, Hamakom, you're... They'll say not yet. They'll say give me a little time, give me another week, right? But what I think is very significant about this prayer is may God have compassion. May God have compassion on you along with all the other sick of Israel. Because you know, sometimes somebody is in such pain, such suffering, that your heart says, you know, let God take them already. Now, can you say such a tefillah or not? The Ran says yes. The Ran is a Rishon, and to the best of my knowledge, nobody argued on this Ran. The Ran is a Rishon, and the Ran said this in the context of the Gemara that talked about Bikur Cholim. The Gemara said you should always visit the sick. If you visit the sick, you can help them and you can bring them back to life. That was a source that you should have seen on... The Ran is in source number 9. And he says, there are times when a person could pray for death. The Ran limits it to a person who is in pain and terminal. He says, such a person, you can pray for death. What's his source? What's his source? Rebbe's maid. Why? What did Rebbe's maid do? She saw that he was terminal, and she saw that he was in pain, and what did she say? God, may be the will that the forces above defeat the forces below. By the way, what else is interesting? First she prayed that he got better. She saw those prayers didn't help, so then she prays that God should take him. The Ran says, therefore we see that this is proper. The Aruch HaShulchan in Source 15, he quotes this, and he says that absolutely you're allowed to pray for someone to die. He says, this is halacha, source 15, Ikur mitzvah bikur cholam hula ayin b'tzarchei hachola. The main mitzvah of bikur cholam is to take care of the needs of the sick person. Ula sot lo mashet sarich, and to do what he needs, to eat the b'derim, as the Gemara said, in derim ma'aseh b'tamad, mitamadaf mitamad Rabbi Kiva shachala, when it tells the story of one of Rabbi Kiva's students who was sick. V'chol ha'mevaker et hachola, gorim lo sheyichya, visiting the sick causes them to live. Why? Shemit palal lo sheyichya. Because you pray for them. Never underestimate your ability to pray and the power of prayer. By the way, go back to the Shittu Mekubetzet. It even said that the power of prayer is so great you can even bring somebody back from the dead. You just don't know you can do that. And therefore, we can't tell you that you can do that. So therefore, if you won't even believe that you can do that. So therefore, you can't know that. Right? If you remember that what I felt was a remarkable source. He goes on then to say, if you don't visit the sick, then you won't ask for compassion. Not that they should live or they should die. There are times that you should pray for somebody that they should die. Kigon sheyesh lo yisurim, if they are in incredible pain, yisurim harbe, they're in incredible pain, because of their illness, v'yef sher shol yichya, k'masad Rebbe b'perakanose, the same case as Rebbe, which is, he's using Rebbe's maid as his source by saying, there are times he can pray for death. Now again, I think this is very, very interesting, because it tells us something about attitude. All things equal, we want life. All things equal, we want life and quality of life. But things are not always equal. And therefore, what we see in these couple of sources, that there are times that you can pray for death. Rav Moshe hates this, by the way. Rav Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva here that I have for you. Yeah, 18. Where he says that in order to pray for someone to die, you first had to pray for them to live, but he ends up limiting it so much. He goes, but it's only the kind of person whose prayers are normally accepted by God. And he says, there's nobody in our generation that I know of who is able to pray like that. So he limits it. As I said, the Aruch HaShulchan argues, and the Aruch HaShulchan, I have to admit, has a stronger case. Why? Because he has a source in the Gemara, he has a Rishon, the Ran. Nobody argued with the Ran. So why not? And even if Moshe admits that the Ran is right, but he just says, no, but you have to have, you know, been on a higher level to do this. The Aruch HaShulchan makes no limitations like this. And, you know, my guts tells me that the Aruch HaShulchan is a very good source. By the way, as I said, you can avoid all this. How do you avoid it? You pray, God, may you have mercy on the person. And let God already interpret what the best plan is. Maybe I don't have to play God and decide what the mercy should be. Let God have, what I want is God to have mercy. Do I understand exactly how these things work? No, I don't understand. God, have mercy. Please have mercy on the person. God can already decide how the mercy should play itself out. Let's move then towards the difficult conclusion. Based on everything that we've said till now, there are times that you're allowed to pray for death, even though we think life is precious. How life is precious? How precious is life? Your life is so precious that you all know that you're allowed to break Shabbat to save a life. This is without any question on it. Can you break Shabbat if someone's going to die anyway?
Yeah.
Why? So the Mishnah Brura has a very interesting quote in Source 16. He quotes the Meiri by saying you're allowed to break Shabbat even if you're going to give the person another 5 minutes. Even if it's going to give them 5 more minutes. Well, again, even though everyone thinks life is more important than Shabbat, right? Isn't that what all of us think? Yes or no?
Yes.
What did the Gemara say? Why do you break Shabbat to save a life? He says you break one Shabbat so they can keep lots of other Shabbatot. That's what the Gemara says. What does that mean? What's more important, Shabbat or life? Shabbat's more important. Now, nonetheless, what does it say? I'm allowed to break Shabbat, even though I know they're going to die, in 5 more minutes I can break Shabbat to give them 5 more minutes. Why? So he says it's the quality of those 5 minutes. He writes in Source 16, where it's underlined, K'moshe katava me'iri b'yoma, ve'afo pishanit barer she'iyef shalo l'chiyot afilu sha'achad, sheba'oto sha'a yashuv b'libo v'yitvadeh, ad kan l'shana. Last, you know, like in the movies, last rites, last moment, fix your soul, fix your... Hold it, we started today with some non-Jew who goes, jumps in the fire and gets into the world to come in those last, in the execution, last 2 minutes. Saving somebody's life to give them the time to say vidui is significantly important. You can break Shabbat to say that vidui. Don't ask. I cut out what's the continuation of the source of it. The halacha is you break Shabbat for a non-Jew as well. It's for other reasons. It's a more complicated rationale. The bottom line halacha is you break Shabbat for a non-Jew as well, but the reason for this is not so simple. Again, it's not because life is more important than Shabbat. That we've already seen, but this is fascinating because it ends up over here that you break Shabbat in order to give this person a moment to get into the world to come. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach says, he goes one step further. He goes, what if the person is unconscious and you still give them another 5 minutes? He says, absolutely. You don't know what goes on. You don't know. You don't know what goes on in the human mind. You break Shabbat even to give them another 2 minutes, 3 minutes, what makes no difference. You break Shabbat. Despite that the rationale is you break one Shabbat, have many Shabbatot. So let's move over then to what may be the most difficult part, and that is, okay, so based on everything we've seen, what should the conclusion be? Are you allowed to pull the plug or not pull the plug? Do you put somebody on a respirator? Do you not put them on a respirator? And the truth is, you've seen a lot, I mean, should life be the most important thing under any circumstances? So, first of all, what's the answer to that? There's no simple answer to this. Look, a year ago, when my father-in-law it was on Father's Day 1 year ago. So he was suffering from Parkinson's, and apparently he had a stroke. And being that it was Father's Day and he was in a home to recover, there was nobody on duty. There was nobody there. And my brother-in-law called up around 2 o'clock in the morning, and he said that apparently he had some kind of a stroke or something, because he's turning completely blue, he's not breathing. Part of the problem with Parkinson's is that you all know that it affects muscles, right? But it also affects muscles inside, including breathing, right?
It also affects the brain.
Everything. So over here, so my brother-in-law calls me up, and he's standing outside the room, and I said, what happened? They called the ambulance. He's not breathing. How much time? 10 minutes, 15 minutes go by. Nothing, till they come. So I said, when they come, I said, what are they doing? He said, they went into the room with him, Hatzalah, and they closed the door. So I said, and what are they doing? He goes, they're going to try to bring him back. I said, go in and tell them to stop. Why? Because what's the most they can do at that point? What? They could put on a respirator. And by the way, it goes back to legal issues. If you answer a call, an ambulance answers a call, they must, by law, treat the person. So I said, what are they doing? The best case scenario is that they're going to be able to bring him back, and who knows what kind of brain damage in 15 minutes, who knows what kind of brain damage, bring him back and put him on a respirator. Right. I said, absolutely. You walk in there and say, and as soon as he walked in, he said, no, I'm his son. I don't want you to do anything. I said, fine. Yeah, absolutely. I said, fine, because they knew that it was an absurdity. But by law, again, it all comes back to this legal point, which is so troubling. Is one obligated to put somebody on a respirator? So let's stop right there. It depends on the case. Every case is different. If God forbid somebody has a heart attack or a stroke, you want to stabilize them, you want to get them on a respirator, you want to wait for the first 24, 48 hours and see what happens. What happens afterwards? Theoretically, a person could live for another 10, 20, 30 years. Right? On the other hand, you can have somebody who is absolutely not alive, and what I've completely avoided today is what is the definition of death? Because that's not a simple topic. But you can have somebody who has no brain function, who has no function whatsoever, but it's a respirator with keeping them alive. So now tell me, based on everything we've studied today, what should be the conclusion in such a case? Is the respirator giving life, or is a respirator preventing death? And you now hopefully realize a respirator is not always doing one of the, it depends on the case. But there are going to be cases where a respirator is not giving life, it is preventing death. In such cases, most poskim in America are remarkably conservative, and for some reason feel that people should be put on respirators and do everything they can. I do not understand it. Correct. Now, okay. One can, again, using what I'm saying today on a practical level, to use it, if any of you are doctors, please not listen to a word that I'm saying. What I am telling you now is really what I consider to be the objective of any halacha class. What is it? To know when to ask a question. Which means in cases like this, one needs to ask a question. That's the issue over here. Who? What?
We said that. We can do all we want, but in the individual cases, you're always asking around.
Right. In case, but you have to know to ask. I'm saying, and who you ask will make a difference in these cases. Rav Voldenberg, who I quoted last time, it's Eliezer. He believed in cases where somebody was brain dead and on a respirator. He just followed the logic that we did today clearly. And what was his conclusion? The respirator is not giving life; it is preventing death. And a person should take them off the respirator. As I said, many other poskim are far more conservative about this, because if you pull the respirator, the person's going to die. I accept absolutely the comment that we don't always know what's going on, and to be able to determine whether, in fact, the respirator, or for that matter, the medical treatment is giving life or preventing death is not always a simple question, but that's the case. That's what this whole issue boils down to. Are you allowed to pray for someone to die? We've seen yes. We've seen remarkable people who even wanted to say there are times that you could cause death. Most of those sources, I feel, are just not appropriate, are not true, are based upon, again, extreme situations, and I would not want to ever bring those discussions, into the discussion of euthanasia, because I think it's based upon an incorrect understanding. When we go to the issue of actually pulling the plug, it depends on the medical situation. Every case is different, but as you've seen, this is going to become the point of contention, that there will be times that Rabbanim will say, it's not giving life, it's preventing death, one can pull the plug. On the other hand, Rabbanim will say at the same time, one needs to give all normal medical procedures if somebody is in, you know, even the most, you know, extreme situation. You should be giving them food, you should be giving them water, you should be giving them medications, you should be giving them all kinds of things that they need, and to withhold any of that would be considered to be murder. But it comes down to this fundamental question. Are we giving life or preventing death? And as I said, that isn't going to be a medical question as much as it's going to be a rabbinic question, but you've seen today all of the issues involved in this. There are some questions here. Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid, Germany, 800 years ago.
Given that it's always an individual situation, those poskim who say you cannot pull the plug, do any of them say you can, however, not put them on a respirator?
Rav Moshe once said something even better. Those who say you can't pull the plug, will they say that you shouldn't put don't put it on? Yes. There will be people who say don't put it on, right? There will be those who say you shouldn't put them on. Rav Moshe wanted to say at one point, whenever you put somebody on a respirator, to avoid the trauma of pulling the plug, he said, put on a respirator which will be automatically set up that will stop every 24 hours. Then you have to make a new decision whether to put them back on the respirator or not. As I said, Rav Moshe in this case, if the person really is not alive, brain dead, being kept alive by the respirator, Rav Moshe is being more conservative than Rav Waldenberg, which is, it's interesting, it's completely parallel to what we saw last time, and Rav Waldenberg would say, if such a case, it's very simple. You have the case of Rebbe's maid, you have the case of the wood chopper, it's brought in the Shulchan Aruch, and what does it say there? You are permitted to stop it, or the way that he formulated in the Darkei Moshe, you're obligated to take away an impediment to death. Correct.
And there have been so many medical advancements up since that time. Has there been anybody else who has, I don't want to say updated, I'll say, or changed any of his original tshuvas?
Look.
I mean, even a child.
The answer is yes. The answer is yes, but most of the debate that took place right after he died was over what he really said. And there's a very big argument, mostly dealing with what is the moment of death and what is the definition of death. Rabbi Tendler claimed that Rav Moshe said one thing, others claimed that he said something else. There was a very big argument. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, who then outlived Rav Moshe by another 10 years, he became the main person on most of these issues, and he was not all that different from Rav Moshe in most of the things, and updated. What most people are doing today is that Rav Moshe, again, lived in modernity, understood the issues involved. His last couple of tshuvot that he wrote are extremely modern, and despite any breakthroughs that we have, they're not fundamental breakthroughs, they're details, and therefore Rav Moshe's writings are still sufficient to have the debate as far as what to do. We haven't gotten to the point yet that Rav Moshe is obsolete, and we can just need that next level. You do need Rabbanim who are willing to go and make decisions on this, and as I've said, I've seen many, many people, as you said, dying first, many, many people who just say, no, you can't take off a respirator, once on a respirator, there's nothing to talk about. And to put on the respirator, which again, to me, is a remarkable statement, considering some of the things that we've seen over here today. Listen, we shouldn't be in such situations, and we should all live full and full lives, and not have to make such decisions. Oh, I was going to end with a joke. My wife sent me an email today. She sent me an email this morning. She said that a husband and wife were having a conversation, and the husband said, if I ever get to the situation that I'm just being kept alive by, electrical machines and by, a bottle and a drip, I want you to disengage me. So she went over and turned off the television, took away his beer.